I'm here today with Jason Jones, and we're moving into the March for Life this year. And as you know, Jason Jones is behind a number of films and documentary about human dignity and the pro-life cause, including Bella. Jason Jones, welcome on.
Aloha, Taylor. It's great to be on your show. I'm a huge fan, so this is exciting for me.
You're saying aloha, but you're not in Hawaii. You're in Chicago.
I'm in Chicago, yes. On my way to Washington, D.C. for the March for Life. Sick as a dog, so if I sneeze, excuse me. Forgive me.
Hey, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive you. You're not in Hawaii. You're in Chicago, so you're on route. You're making your way over to D.C.
Making my way to D.C., yes.
Okay. So people that don't know Jason Jones, he's a film producer, author, activist, human rights worker. He's president of Movement and the Human Rights Education Organization, HERO. In 2006, Jones was executive producer of Bella. All of us in the Catholic Church in America know that film, which won several awards. And he's also the associate producer for the film Stoning of Soraya M., which won the L.A. Film Festival Award in 2009, as well as the NAACP Image Award in 2012. He was the producer of the TV movie Mother Marian, Portrait of a Saint, and executive producer of the new film Voiceless. His short films include Eyes to See, 2010, Crescendo, and Sing a Little Louder. Jason works directly to aid the homeless, people facing genocide, and women with crisis pregnancies. He's a regular contributor to Christian news site The Stream, as are some of our other guests. And he's the author of two books, The Race to Save Our Century, and his most recent, The World is on Fire, released in 2017. All right, Jason, good bio there. Before we jump into this, why don't we pray? I invite everyone to pray with us. And here we go. We'll pray the Our Father in Latin. Nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui est in Caeli, sanctificetur nomen tuum, advenia regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in cielo et in terra. Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis odie, et dimitte nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Amen. Nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. All right. Here we are. So I saw Bella back in when it first came out. I was in D.C. I was at the CIC, and there's a filming of it there. And I don't know if we met. Would you have been there?
Yeah, you know, I was there. But usually people come up to me and say, I was at the screening of Bella at such and such.
And Eduardo Oklahoma,
was there. It's like, oh, I met you then. I was standing right next to Eduardo. No, you weren't. No, I was there. And they see Eduardo and now, you know.
Right. Yeah.
They don't, so you were probably mesmerized by Eduardo and didn't notice.
Yeah. Actually, when they came to town, I remember the whole crew was there. There were a lot of people there for like the week. And I went with a priest and myself and Eduardo to lunch. And that's the only time I've ever really met him. Cool guy.
And that was a great screening. And because the CIC, I became a Catholic in my early 30s working in Washington, D.C., and the CIC played a role in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was great to show Bella there. And we also had a screening at the National Geographic Society. And like members of the Supreme Court came. And Laura Ingraham, who was battling cancer in the midst of her struggle, came. And right. I remember thinking, okay, movies might be the way to go to achieve my goals.
Yeah.
You know, that was surreal.
We met here in a few months ago. How long has it been now that we met here in Dallas?
Yeah, 4 months ago.
Yeah, you were the keynote speaker at a pro-life event and just completely took our breath away. If you'd like, I'd love for you to share that story. You want to do that?
Yeah, you know, well, coming to Chicago, just I'm here for work and I'm at a donor's house who's invested in my next movie and a good friend, and I'm on my way to D.C. for the march. But I'm originally from Chicago, so I've lived in Hawaii since I was 17. But it was 31 years ago this week that I was going to O'Hare Airport, leaving home, which turned out to be forever. I didn't realize that at the time because I was going off to Fort Benning, Georgia for basic training 31 years ago this week. And that was really also the beginning of my pro-life journey because a lot of people think my involvement and pro-life came through movies. But really I've been in the pro-life movement at 30 years, you know, this year. And it all started here in Chicago when I was 16 2 days before my 17th birthday, I was lying in bed on a Saturday morning when I heard someone coming up my stairs and my door opened. I thought it was my little sister. And I got nudged and I opened my eyes and it was my high school girlfriend. And she woke me up. She rode her bike 5 miles. She rode her bicycle 5 miles to my house to tell me she was pregnant. And the two of us spent that day kind of conspiring what we were going to do. And a friend of mine had just dropped out of high school and went right into basic training in a special program. So I'd said to my high school girlfriend, Katie, on my birthday, which is in 2 days, I'll go down to the recruiter's office and join the Army. And, you know, I'll be a man. I'll have a job. And we can get you through school. And I was a football player, and I had visions of, like, we'll get you through school, and then you go to college. Then I get out of the Army, and I can go to college and play football. And so that was sort of the plan. And I remember Katie said, I'll wear baggy sweaters and take vitamins till you get back, and we'll tell my parents when you get back. And so that's what we did. On my birthday, I went down to the recruiter's office in my letter jacket, clean cut. And the recruiter looked at me and said, oh, this program your friend went into, you wouldn't qualify for. And I thought, what do you mean? He said, well, this is for juvenile delinquents. This is for troubled kids. You look like you have your act together. And well, looks can be deceiving. And I said to the recruiter, well, you know, I wasn't going to tell them about the pregnancy, but I said, you know, out of 565 kids in my class, I'm last, which was true. I was last in my class. And I, you know, some more embarrassing information. And he's like, you qualify.
Right. And you're basically delinquent. There you go. Right.
Yeah. Congratulations. You qualify. And he gave me a form. He said, if your principal signs this, your mom signs this, we'll get you into the very next basic training class. And so my mom signed it, my principal signed it, and off I went to Fort Benning, Georgia. And, you know, 31 years ago this week, I was at O'Hare with my Scooby-Doo pillowcase, my toiletries in the pillowcase.
That was your luggage?
That was my luggage, yeah. And a girlfriend at home pregnant. And when I got to basic training, I was identified as an atheist. And so I didn't go to church on Sundays.
Were you raised atheist or nothing?
I was raised with really no religion.
Yeah.
Into Ayn Rand. You know, I was a little Randian.
Really? In high school you were?
Yeah, well, in eighth grade I had read Anthem and Kurt Vonnegut's Harrison Bergeron.
Okay, interesting.
And the short story in that novella really, in the midst of the Oliver North hearings, reading Ayn Rand, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't go to church on Sundays. I cleaned pots and pans. And so I was two Sundays away from coming home from basic training. And I couldn't believe that my, you know, 5'2", 90-pound girlfriend was hiding this pregnancy this long. But two Sundays before coming home, I was cleaning pots and pans. And a friend came to grab me that my girlfriend had called and she was crying. And I ran out and I answered the phone, and Katie was crying like I have never heard anyone cry in my life. Actually, once later on in life, when a friend's brother committed suicide and she called me, it was that same jarring type of soul-wrenching crying. And she couldn't talk. And then finally her father said over the other line, we know your secret and your secret's gone. I took Katie to get an abortion.
Mm.
And a drill sergeant hung up the phone because I wasn't supposed to be on the phone. I hit him. And they pulled me into my captain's office where I was begging my captain to call the police because, Taylor, I didn't know abortion was legal.
Right.
As strange as that sounds, I had never been to church a day in my life. I really remembered some jokes I had heard about abortion, some kind of gross dead baby jokes or weird Planned Parenthood jokes I would have heard in the locker room, but I never thought too much about it. It kind of all came flooding back into my mind, but I didn't know abortion was legal. And I was just begging my captain to call the police. And he gave me a Cliff Notes explanation of Roe v. Wade. Taylor, I didn't know that I wasn't really thoughtful that abortion was a thing until I found out I lost my daughter to an abortion.
Right.
We know the baby's a girl because the abortionist, by the way, her father was a very prominent Catholic. He was very close friends with Cardinal Bernardine, was one of his best friends. And but he took his daughter to Chicago Masonic Hospital where she had a forced third trimester abortion.
Mm.
And the abortionist said to her after the procedure, by the way, you had a little girl. So that's how I set my hair on fire. And I promised Katie if it took me the rest of my life, I'd end abortion. I got to my duty station in Hawaii and I just started going door to door in my off time, not knowing that there was, I did not know the word pro-life. I did not know the word pro-life movement or pro-life, pro-choice. And I would go door to door in Hawaii, just knocking on doors, asking people if they knew that abortion was legal and if they thought it should be illegal and if they would help me knock on doors next week. And this is sort of how I started.
So that, I mean, that's a horrific story. And I mean, it also, it reveals the hypocrisy in our own Catholic Church. You know, when you look at the demographics of Catholics, when it comes to approval of abortion, contraception, LGBT, many of these social issues, Catholics are not much better than just your unchurched sector. Even evangelicals usually blow us out of the water on all of these numbers. Why do you think that is? Before we move on, it's an interesting thing that, you know, here's a guy who's a friend of the cardinal but would take his daughter to a Masonic hospital for a third trimester abortion.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, and this is going to sound like I shouldn't even say it out loud because it sounds so kooky. But I was became so militantly anti-abortion. I became this like anti-abortion Randian. I saw an Ayn Rand. Mm. I wrote my conversion story for National Review. It was how Roe v. Wade, Ayn Rand, and Sartre made me Catholic. but when I had sort of became, when I woke up to the reality of abortion, all I had was this little book from my post library called Roe v. Wade in Focus that was published by Planned Parenthood's research arm, Alan Guttmacher Institute. And I had that book and my experience. There was no Google. There was no cable news. I was a 17-year-old private in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii, trying to come to understand about abortion. And it was my connection to Catholics that made me radically anti-Catholic. So my atheism was radicalized by the abortion because I had a prominent Catholic man take my girlfriend, his daughter, to get a forced abortion. And then the Catholics in my family were the most pro-abortion that I was discovering. And so my atheism, my radical atheism was birthed by an abortion. Because it's on Ayn Rand, I went back and I appealed to this sort of radical individualism, and I forgave her for being pro-abortion, said she was an old woman, you know, who didn't understand biology and she didn't get it. So I could forgive her for that. But then all the Catholics I was running into, so much so, like, this is embarrassing to say, when I graduated college after the Army, I went to the University of Hawaii, I put down my three goals in life, which were to end abortion, destroy the Catholic Church, and develop Ayn Rand's metaphysics and epistemology. These were my three life goals. Because
and how old are you when you come up with the three goals?
I mean, I was 20, in my mid-20s, going to the University of Hawaii.
Yeah.
And I would go to the Newman Center, and, you know, I was coming to understand that Catholics should see themselves as pro-life. And I know people are listening. How could you have been so ignorant? Do you know, I read Windswept House in 1996, and it confirmed everything. Like, I was going to try to organize the Newman Center on my campus, being driven off by an effeminate priest. Mm. I would talk to people at the diocese, and they would give me the runaround. But I would go to these evangelical churches. I would even go to the mosque. I would go everywhere and try to get people to help me in this cause to end abortion. Is this uneducated? Remember, I was last in my class in high school. And I was in the infantry, and I'm just trying to cobble it together. And then, of course, in the mid '90s, we get Netscape, and I'm Netscaping around and trying to learn and try to understand. But I saw Catholics as my biggest obstacle. And so that's really, like, I still have the journal where I wrote those as my goals.
It's amazing. So do I understand it correctly? The reason that you wanted to destroy the Catholic Church is because you had this experience of your daughter being aborted by her Catholic father, and the hypocrisy. Is that right?
Yeah, the hypocrisy. And what was really offensive to me was the seamless garment that I was running into everywhere. Ooh, that was branding. Yeah, and people confuse what I do with whole life with that. It's no, mm-hmm. it's flipped. I created the Whole Life Initiative to sort of undo that I really came to understand that it was Bernadine and this consistent ethics tactic that was the number one reason in the 80s when we had victory within our grasp, that it slipped right out from our fingers. And I really do blame Ted Kennedy and Cardinal Bernadine with sort of and the Jesuits around the Kennedys with concocting this argument that when we were gaining power in both parties, it just slipped right from our fingertips. And so as a man who lost his own child to an abortion, comparing abortion to unlike incommensurate issues like Cardinal Supich did in an editorial following the release of the Dalyden videos where he compared it to minimum wage increase, I can't begin to tell you how offensive that is to me as a man who lost his child to a forced abortion. And I even try to explain to my pro-abortion, even my pro-abortion friends get it. They're like, you know, if you lost your kid to a drunk driver and somebody was trying to compare laws against drunk driving to laws against plastic straws, you would find that really offensive because they're unlike and they're incommensurate. And I believe that that's a tactic that was by design to submerge abortion in a sea of prudential issues. And my anti-abortion work was indistinguishable, and it was not separated from the very beginning for me, because I was a young infantryman. And as a young man on deployment, I got to see how privileged I was and how violent the world was. And so from the very beginning for me, I wasn't a Catholic yet, but I'll call it my apostolate, was to protect the vulnerable from violence. And I never saw the child in the womb different from than maybe the child in Thailand or the Yazidi girl on Mount Sinjar. To me, they were always connected. So if you see my writing going back to the mid-90s while I was still a student, I'm writing as much on war and genocide and democide as I am abortion. And genocide and democide and unjust total war, you can compare that to abortion, right? You can compare the firebombing of Dresden or dropping an atomic bomb in the center of Nagasaki to an abortion. But you cannot compare the best way to provide, you know, to order an economy, or what should minimum wage be? There should be no minimum wage, or $9 or $12. That's an unlike incommensurate issue to the direct intentional killing of an innocent human person. And as a father who lost his child to the direct intentional killing of abortion, that is the number one thing that boils my blood, is the misuse of Catholic social teaching to defend abortion. But it was wrestling with that that led me to becoming Catholic. But at the time, at the very beginning, I was really an anti-Catholic bigot, to put it mildly. I really was.
Yeah. And just for people that know, I think everybody who watches here knows, but the seamless garment was this thesis that was made popular by Cardinal Bernadine in Chicago. And that is, every issue that pertains to human life is a seamless garment, like the robe of our Lord on his passion. And so he would say, you know, you can't just vote as a Republican to end abortion. You also have to take care of and vote for all the other issues pertaining to human life. So pro-life is all of these things. Now, in a sense, that's true. But what it does is it equals out everything. And there's no hierarchy there of crimes against human life. Obviously, you can only have an increase or decrease in minimum wage if you were born and grew up and can now be a worker, right? So, I mean, the right to life is fundamental to any other life, or any other issue, whether it's, you know, war or genocide or even things like immigration or minimum wage. So this is Bernadine is a snake. He is not a good guy. I've done a whole show on Bernadine. Go check it out. This cardinal was good buddies with McCarrick, and basically just destroyed the Catholic Church in America with McCarrick.
And I would say, in a very personal way, gets an assist in the destruction of my child, because he was friends with this man, this prominent Catholic man. Right. And if he had been a strong, forceful advocate for life in an authentically consistent way, it would have formed this man, his friend, who would have responded differently to this pregnancy than he did. So in a very direct way, I believe Cardinal Bernadine was involved in the destruction of my child. And, you know, what this seamless garment really devolves down to is what John Smerick and I have written about, and we call it the preferential option for myself. You know, it's really, in the end, whatever these prudential issues, however they benefit me personally, mm-hmm. those become the preeminent issues. You don't see the consistent life folks speaking out vocally about what's happening to the Uyghur and Chinese occupied East Turkestan, or what's happening to the Yazidi or the Chaldeans or the people, the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. It really comes down to their perceived economic benefit from a certain policy, right. and not even the economic benefit of others, their perceived economic benefit. So in the end, it's rather than thinking of the other, it is to use Catholic social teaching as a weapon to benefit yourself. And if you're in a person in a position to do that, you're privileged. You've had a formation and education that I would say you're a privileged person in society already.
So you left off there when I just wanted to clarify that point, but you left off on, yeah. on the hypocrisy here making you anti-Catholic. And, you know, before I was a Catholic, I had a bit of anti-Catholicism too that was from hypocrisy. I remember working with a guy who, you know, was living a pretty dissolute life, but was a Catholic, you know, and telling me all these crazy things he was doing. And, you know, as being, by that time I was, you know, more of a evangelical style Protestant, but just being perplexed by this, it reestablishes the presupposition that non-Catholics have. And that is live like a hellion, be promiscuous, contradict the church, and then just go into a little box. Right. And then start doing it all over again. Like there's no change of heart. It's almost like you're just pulling levers on a candy machine and getting your candy, but you're not invested in any real faith or repentance or anything like that. Now you and I are both Catholics now, so we know that that's a caricature, and there are people.
We know that they're not even going in the little box.
What's that?
They're not even going in the little box.
Right.
That's the wishful thinking that they're even going in the little box.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we thought. Like, oh, they just live like hell and they go in the little box, and then surprise, surprise, they're not even going to confession.
Yeah.
Because they're told by the priest, just repent, just believe.
My daughter texted me once after confession that the priest had told her to stop coming to confession, that she was without sin. She said, your daughter's is immaculate. I'm like, that's good to know.
When I was in college, we used to do these, we'd go around campuses and we'd spend a whole Saturday trying to convert people as evangelicals. And I remember we would sit down with people and we would just say, the classic line was, if you died right now, where would you go? Some college kids have thought about this. Some of them are totally shocked, And I remember sitting down with this girl, if you died right now, where'd you go? She said, I'd go to heaven. I was like, well, why is that? And she said, because I never sinned. I said, wow, you've never sinned your whole life? She's like, never have. And I was like, are you religious? She's like, yeah, I'm a Catholic. I'm like, what?
She's never sinned. That's
yeah, she
awesome.
Never sins. Like, are you the Blessed Mother? Is this an apparition? What's going on here? But just the horrible formation that we've had for so many decades, going back into the 60s, we could even say into the 50s. And it's not just horrible formation of the lay people, it's of the clergy too.
It's sad. Well, when I was an Ayn Rand objectivist, I never sinned. If you want a worldview that's easy to live up to and you're a guy in your 20s, Ayn Rand is a good place to be.
Yep.
Yeah,
young men, I've noticed this. I think maybe St. Augustine said this about the Manichaeans. But it also sort of applies to, I think, maybe Calvinism too. And that it may be Ayn Rand, but really high ideals, but no expectation to fulfill them in your personal life. I think Augustine criticized the Manichaeans on that. So you have a really high philosophy that's very, thought out, and you talk about it and read books and all that. But then there's no expectation to have a clear morality. And I think Augustine experienced that as a Manichaean. And man, if you're a 22-year-old guy, it's great.
Yeah. Ayn Rand is like, it's like six of the commandments, right? And it removes, the hard ones for 20-year-old guys.
Yeah.
So it's like easy. It's, oh, I'm a saint.
Yeah.
This is easy. Only six commandments.
Right. Wait, so which one does she drop?
I mean, theoretically, sexual morality is out the window.
Yeah,
I would just be envy. Coveting, envy. Take out all the commandments. The first three commandments are chopped out.
Right.
And take out, I guess, the fifth.
Fifth is murder.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Adultery. Where are we?
Six.
Yeah, so just the first three and then six. Mm-hmm. And then you have the others.
Yeah, there you go.
That's pretty easy for a 25-year-old.
Yeah, college dudes
in America.
Have that. Yeah. Right? Don't have to worry about going to mass. Yeah,
no. What's that?
You don't have to worry about going to mass. No, keep holy the Sabbath day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lust is unchecked as long as it doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah, so I was a sinless Randy, and although as a Catholic, I am addled with sin.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting too. Every once in a while, you meet some Christians. They tend to be Protestant, though, but maybe there's some Catholic ones out there that are still like super into Ayn Rand and all that. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not as harsh on Ayn Rand as and she's like an easy horse that we like to virtue signal and mm-hmm. smash Ayn Rand. I really still admire her in that here you have a woman who was born in Tsarist Russia, whose family suffered under pogroms. And, you know, when the Christians every Easter would ride into Jewish communities and slaughter them, and they'd have to flee to Germany, strangely enough, for safety, you know, during Lent and Easter. And then the Bolsheviks come and they're even more violent. So this young woman, if she heard somebody using the word altruism, she knew they were about to kill her or try to kill her. So you have a woman who kind of came from that, and then growing up in the midst of the 20th century, which was a totalitarian hell brought to us by collectivists. I understand what animated Ayn Rand, and there's sort of this hatred for her where we forgive Sartre, who was a Stalinist. We forgive Heidegger, who joined the Nazi party. Yeah. And yet this Jewish woman who is standing up to these totalitarian thugs, we just want to hate. Right. For me, she pointed to, and how I say Ayn Rand was the first step into me becoming Catholic, is this she exalted the individual. I say when I went from being a Randian to a Catholic, I went from being an individualist to a personalist. I no longer saw us as individuals, but as persons. But what Ayn Rand helps you understand, I think what's attractive to her about young people, it's not sort of this element of her that's connected to Nietzsche. I don't think that's what's attracting young people. If they'd be attracted to Nietzsche if that's what they wanted. But it's this vision of the human person, the celebration of the dignity and beauty and grandeur of the individual that is, she would call self-evident. It's axiomatic. And that was never a good answer for me. And that is what led me to searching for an anthropology for the vision of the human person that I saw as self-evident without revealed religion. I wanted to do that without revealed religion. But it was reading Sartre that helped me understand that the only, even though he was denying it, was the only explanation for the vision of the human person that to me was self-evident was Christian revelation on the nature and dignity of the human person, which for me was frustrating because especially for sexual morality, because I was pro-life, but I was a boy in his 20s who was an atheist and living like a boy in his 20s who was an atheist would live. But I wanted anything else to explain it but that. And when I sort of narrowed it down to this is the only explanation, but it is undeniable. I say that my conversion began with finding God in the mirror, which was I couldn't reject the beauty of the human person. And the only explanation was that we were created by God in his image and likeness. And that is the source of our incomparable dignity, beauty, and worth. And then, of course, the incarnation in an even more deeper way, the incarnation is the great teacher of human dignity to the human race. So, it became inescapable for me as hard as I, and this was over several years I tried to escape. But in the end, I had to acknowledge that I had to reject this idea of the inviolability of the human person or accept the Christian religion.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's troubling. You know, whether you follow Rand, especially if you follow Jean-Paul Sartre or Heidegger, or any of these guys, is, you know, Sartre and the existentialists are trying to establish who they are by what they're doing, right? But they've been cut off by Descartes and everyone before of the human essence, the form, right? And they can't use the language of in the image of God, and they can't use the language of soul. Now, try to defend, the pro-life cause or try to defend human dignity without those two tools in your tool belt, it's going to get really difficult. Is that one of the things that led you to embracing Catholicism?
Yeah, I mean, there was a line, I think it was in Existentialism and Education, where Sartre said that to deny God is to proclaim human dignity in the traditional sense that we do it in the West is to appeal to Christian revelation. And when he said that, I got it immediately. It was sort of like my aha moment. And I had been studying Christianity so that I could speak at churches to get them involved in the pro-life cause. So here I'm an atheist speaking at churches every Sunday. and I would study the Bible in a way to sort of, you know, be more influential in these talks to Christians to get them to stand up for life. But then I was also reading The Gospel of Life by St. John Paul the Great, and Love and Responsibility had a big impact on me as well. And then I was meeting good Catholics, and then I was discovering that, you know, there are the sort of civil war that was happening in the Catholic Church. Is happening, yeah. There's the civil war in the Catholic Church.
I'm like, man, is it over?
You know, I'll tell you a funny story, Taylor. You'll appreciate this. So I had I heard Malachi Martin on the Art Bell show, right?
Yeah.
I was a waiter and I would drink.
You know what's interesting? What's interesting is so many people have not read any of Malachi Martin's books, but they know the Art Bell stuff.
Yeah, no, I would listen to Art Bell. I was a waiter and I'd drink coffee while I was waiting tables so I could do homework after my shift. And I would do my homework and listen to Art Bell. And so this Malachi Martin comes on. I get his book, Windswept House. I read it, and I have it dog-eared, and I have all these little notes. And I go, and there's this university in Hawaii called Chaminade University, and behind it is where these retired brothers live. Well, I didn't know the difference between brothers or priests. I thought they were priests. And I went there with my copy of Windswept House, and I banged on one of the doors on a Saturday morning, and this old guy in his 90s, about 4'11", was a brother. I call him father. He goes, no, I'm a brother. And I'm like, what's that? And I said, can I ask you some questions? This guy just woke up and I'm reading him these different things from Windswept House. I go, do you think this is true? And he said, of course it's true. And I'm like, why would you be Catholic if this is true? Oh. And this guy in his 90s, 4'11", some brother from middle, he was from Illinois, somehow in Hawaii, he said to me, was Lucifer in the Garden of Eden before the fall? I said, yes. Would you leave the Garden of Eden because Lucifer was there? I'm like, I mean, I know nothing about religion. No, I wouldn't do that. Was Judas with Jesus everywhere he went? Yeah. Would you leave Jesus aside because Judas was there? I'm like, no. He's like, why do you want me to leave my church? Because of a bunch of masons and perverts. Now get out of here. And he slams the door. And then years later, I was on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect.
What's that?
Defending the church. Years later, I was on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, and they were attacking the church. And I used his lines, you know. And then all these priests wrote me, great job on Bill Maher. I was surprised how many Catholic priests watched Bill Maher. But I was plagiarizing this old guy. But, you know, for me, I'm so grateful to God that my constancy in the pro-life movement kept me exposed to so many good Catholics. Yeah. And that I was surrounded by ever more good Catholics. And eventually, as a militant atheist, was asked to go work at Human Life International. Wow. Can you believe that? And so I was doing PR for Human Life International as an atheist. Wow. But that put me face to face with many, many good Catholics who forced me to really grapple with what the church teaches, and I could, you know, get past my prejudice.
Yeah. You know, leaving the Catholic Church because of the Freemasons and the perverts. I like that line. You know, there is there's this way to live life, which is eliminate the nasty, the embarrassing, and the pain. That's what abortion is. Right? There's an embarrassment. There's something I don't like. It's not the way my life is going. I'm going to terminate it. Right? Mm. Or I'm in a marriage. I don't like it. It's embarrassing. It's not going how I thought it was going to go. I'm going to terminate it. I'm going to get divorced. Right? And same thing with leaving the church. I don't like this. It's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable. I don't like the way it's going. When I became a Catholic, I didn't know there's going to be all these scandals. I don't like going home at Thanksgiving and everybody saying, man, your church is a mess. So I'm just going to terminate it? No. You see, we as Catholic people, as disciples of Jesus Christ, we stay in the fight.
Yeah, no, it's a fight. I wanted to become Eastern Orthodox because I didn't want to. I compared it to moving to Rwanda. You know, I said, I'm going to becoming Catholic to me is like moving to Rwanda. I'd like to find some little community somewhere that's perfect. But of course, you'll never find that.
Right.
You know, we're a part of a church of over a billion people. A lot of us, myself included, are embarrassing, probably. So we've got to be, that's just the reality. For me, I've been able to see the scandal now more as a stepping stone to my faith, because when I first converted, I come from a family of, you know, my mother had me at 16, was married a lot and divorced. In my family, we've had homicide, suicide, all sorts of problems. And I thought that if I became a Christian, I'd be surrounded by all these perfect people from perfect families that were saints. And I first felt that way. But then as you come to get to know other folks, you realize that families are families, and a family of a billion people is a family of a billion people. And everything you're going to find in China, you're going to find in the Catholic Church. That's just the reality. And that helps us. You know, I think all new converts, I did this for a while. And maybe if not for the scandals, I could have done it to the day I died, which was you turn the church into an ideology. And you have this sort of weird triumphalism that we're a part of this just community of perfect people. I remember the excitement of my conversion in 2000. Well, I assented to the faith in 2000. I was baptized and confirmed in 2002. But you know, you could have this, I don't think it's possible now, but I could tell you in the late 90s and early 2000s, when I saw a lot of folks coming in the church, we were reducing the church to an ideology, which has become impossible to do at this point.
Yes. Well, you know, I think more and more people in 2019 and 20 with McCarrick and the USCCB and Pope Francis and all these things, there is a tendency more and more for people to turn the church into an ideology. Like I'm in communion with the Platonic form of the Catholic Church, right? And you got to be careful with that. That's when you read the New Testament, it's talking about the church. It's not talking about the Platonic form. It's talking about the actual church. But, you know, the good news is the church really isn't just McCarrick and Bernadine. The church is the church triumphant in heaven, the church purgative, suffering in purgatory, and the church militant here on earth. It's all of that. Right. And so I think we can look to the church triumphant and realize that's where we want to go, and realize down here in the church militant, not everyone's going to make it. And maybe some people will make it that were surprised, but it's not over yet. It's a militant. It's a war.
Yeah. Hello?
We got guests.
I'm still on. Sorry. That's my investor in my movie.
Oh, so you want to come in and say hi?
Do you want to come and say hi? She doesn't want. She's a huge fan, but she said no.
Okay.
Yes, I am a huge fan.
This is live, by the way. What awesome. Am I going to do?
Awesome. Hey.
All right.
It's live. You know, my daughters come in all the time.
Okay.
Before we ran, they're like, we need breakfast, Dad. I'm like, just get some snacks.
And, so if you were my dad, I'd have like a clown mask and sneak up behind you every once in a while and look over your shoulder.
I think that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, like a Chucky mask. Okay, sorry about that.
All right, so how did you break through, and what was the conversion I think you told me that you even were married and had a family and you still weren't Catholic yet. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I became, you know, I got married at 18, had two children.
Okay.
My kids were being raised Catholic. Their mom was Catholic.
Okay.
I refused to go to Mass. Thank God for the priest that we ended up getting married by a Unitarian minister under a waterfall in Hawaii.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's
well, I was
so Hawaiian, man.
Yeah, well, I was in the Army, you know, 18-year-old boy. But we went to her priest, her family's priest. She was from Hawaii. And he said, "Will you raise your children Catholic?" I said, "Whatever fairy tale that they want to teach, you know, I'll let them teach the children, you know." And he said, "No, I won't marry you." And that was just so great. So that when I did get married, I just had to get a decree of nullity, you know, because I had never been baptized. and I was married by a Unitarian minister under a waterfall.
Yeah.
So if this priest would have been kind and nice, if he'd have been nice,
right,
he could have made my life very difficult. And in the long run, to have a sacramental marriage.
Right.
So wow. I got to thank him 10 years later, 15 years later, I ran into him and I thanked him.
Yeah. Unitarian under a waterfall.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in front of the waterfall, not literally.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe in a cave. You know?
No. I had two children and they were Catholic and my daughter's very Catholic. And they were, in fact, when I started going to Protestant church first, an evangelical church, a beautiful community, Calvary Chapel, and my kids being so Catholic, I go, isn't this better than Catholic church? Like there's a coffee shop and a bookstore and pop music. And
so cool.
My children were like, no, this is horrible. Please just don't ever bring us there again. They were very Catholic.
Yeah, I love it when kids who are raised Catholics as teens, and they actually end up, you know, in college or high school going with their friends to some of these churches, they're shocked that there's no altar in the whole space.
Yeah.
Like, Dad, there was not an altar in that whole place. What are they doing? You know?
Right here, I thought my kids would love it. I thought they'd be so excited
so
by it.
So cool. There's cool coffee, get your Java.
Yeah, they're like, no, this is horrible.
And meanwhile, we have monsignors and pastors who are trying to make Catholic churches more like that.
No, yeah, my dad, who is a hippie. I mean, literally, like, he's just in a cult movie on like marijuana, okay. You know. But he's now Catholic again. But when I was trying to get him, he was raised Catholic. Never, you know, had a horrible experience as a boy in the church and left. But when I first brought him to Mass, he's like, are they singing a Cat Stevens song? Sure enough, they were.
They were. Like,
yeah, I didn't realize. He's like, look. Cool. And my dad was just furious. I'm like, if this hippie Maoist from the, you know, back in the 60s, it's my dad, is offended by Cat Stevens in the liturgy, no one is happy. No one is happy with Cat Stevens in the liturgy. Nobody.
All right, so...
Man, not even Cat Stevens. He'd have been like, whoa, no.
Can you, if our Lord doesn't come back in another couple hundred years, and let's say we get this thing straightened out in the next 20 to 50 years, can you imagine the church history books where, you know, they're explaining this era of Catholicism? Like, what a joke it has become in so many ways. I'm talking about morality, the teaching, the preaching, the decline in demographics and numbers, the liturgy. They're going to have all these photographs of insane events in Catholic churches.
Well, let me just give you one example. In the midst of Christians in Iraq, the Chaldeans and the Assyrians, and then the others that are not Christian, like Muslims and the Yazidi, when they were in the midst of a horrible genocide, Christian children being murdered and raped, they were beaming pictures of wild animals that very week onto St. Peter's, right?
Yeah,
talking about global warming, and there were these wild animals. I would have preferred them to beam pictures of Chaldean children. And I was in Iraq at that very week, and a priest with tears in his eyes asked me why we've forgotten them. And he said, why are they beaming wild animals onto basilicas and not beaming the pictures of our children in these IDP camps? And it's really, you know, stumbling across Rene Girard has been helpful for me just to kind of focus my apostolate in that we live in an age where people are being swept away in this mimetic contagion. And that really, as Christians, our job is very simple. That is to live in radical solidarity with the vulnerable, the truly vulnerable. We are so privileged. We're not willing to risk anything. I've been doing a documentary in the Middle East, and whenever I go on one of my trips, everyone's like, aren't you afraid or it's not safe? And I find that so offensive. Like, what do you mean? For me, it's going to be fine, right? I'm not crazy. I'm going to be very thoughtful about how I go and where I go. But there are Christians who are living in the midst of these genocides, but we don't want to take any risk. Mm-hmm. We're not even going to risk making people uncomfortable. So we're only going to talk about climate change because you can talk about climate change and no one gets sick to their stomach. But you bring up, you know, there's still thousands of missing Yazidi girls at a dinner party, and all of a sudden now you've just ruined the conversation, right?
Yes.
We're not even willing to risk ruining the conversation. And that's what I think they'll look to our age as, is totally devoid of empathy, thoughtless, decadent. We're thoughtless and decadent. And I just heard a comedian yesterday. I was flipping through Instagram, and this comedian said, you know, he was talking about cell phones. He said, you know, slavery was bad, but on the other hand, you have to admit, we wouldn't have the pyramids if we didn't have slavery. You know, he said we wouldn't have, and he was going through all these things in history we had because of slavery. And he's like, oh, and we wouldn't have your iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, so here's this comedian. We're like judging people in the past, but right. We know that I'm talking to you through a device that was made by people who are working in horrible like conditions in a country that has millions of Uyghur in concentration camps. And the news never talks about this. We're never thoughtful about this. And I really do think it goes back to Roe v. Wade and abortion, because if we're thoughtless and callous in the destruction of our own children, I don't really believe for one minute we're going to care about Uyghur children or Yazidi children. And so the war to protect the child in the womb from the violence of abortion, those who have the courage to stand with the child in the womb, we're really going to transform our whole world. It all begins with the child in the womb, right? I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, we've all heard that Mother Teresa said the fruit of abortion is nuclear war. We know for a fact that in 1946, Fulton Sheen said in a homily, I have a collection of homilies at Catholic University, that the decriminalization of abortion became inevitable on August 6th and August 9th of 1945, because we've told the world there are no boundaries that we won't cross. And so for those of us who are working to protect the child in the womb this week, that's the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. It's also that we'll have a more thoughtful foreign policy. We'll have more thoughtful trade policy. We'll be more thoughtful when we think about our borders. You know, and all the talk about our borders, this is the misuse of the seamless garment to me, but there's the proper application that we need to protect the vulnerable. We need to have border security and workplace security so that we're protecting vulnerable people from economic exploitation or shutting down human sex trafficking. Yeah. But this all gets washed away. Everything is just virtue signaling because we have this big elephant in the room, which is abortion. So we can't talk about anything real. So let's just talk. Let's make things up. And that's why I am really hopeful. We have this law from Louisiana going before the Supreme Court on March 4th. And Roe v. Wade may be teetering. It may fall. And so it's an exciting time.
Yeah.
And even the bishops had this forceful statement that just came out this week, right? So we'll see.
You know, speaking of March for Life coming up, do you think we'll get another message from Trump? And how do you see Trump in all this? And then how do you think it looks to me like in the last year or two that the USCCB, the United States Conference of Bishops, has kind of taken a step back from pro-life issues? Do you perceive that as well? And how do you think the bishops relate to the March for Life?
Well, I think it's the age of the laity. I don't look to the bishops for leadership on the life issue. I just, at Mass the other day here in Chicago, there was a statement read by the bishops that seemed very forceful to me. But I don't think we should look to our bishops to lead the way.
Yeah, that's sad.
It's just a source of frustration. Well, I heard myself when I said, even the bishops made a strong statement. I'm like, why did I have to say even the bishops, right? You know, it is very sad. But then on the other hand, I think it's our job as the laity. You know, I once saw a very prominent Catholic layman arguing with a great cardinal at this Catholic leadership conference. And the cardinal was saying, it's the lady's job. And this prominent Catholic man was like, it's the bishop's job. And I'm like, I wish the cardinals was saying it's the bishop's job. And this prominent lay Catholic man would say it's the laity's job.
Right.
You know, as a young atheist who is 17 years old, high school dropout, last in his class, when I discovered abortion was legal, I said, I am going to order my life around just one thing, making sure our laws protect children from violence. I didn't think it was anyone else's job. I saw it as my job. And that's 31 years ago. I still see it as my job. And so I don't care about the bishops. I don't care about the Republican Party, the Democrat Party. I have a goal. I've had this goal since 1989. I wrote a 40-year plan as a young soldier. in my barracks in 1991. And I've been trying to hit my milestones and try to complete this plan by November 18th, 2031. But I think we each should make it our own personal responsibility. Start in our parish, start in our neighborhood. And then before you know it, you'll be surprised how much influence you have on the process.
It seems that, you know, there's a lot of awareness when y'all put Bella out. But then also the recent film Unplanned also brought a lot of attention, even especially from the secular side of things, people debating it, talking bad about it, trying to ban it in places. Compare your experience with Bella with Unplanned. Are we going to see more movies like this, and are they helpful? What's the future look like?
Yeah, no, I think we were seeing a constant stream of pro-life movies. You know, when I founded Movie to Movement in 2007, people said, how many movies can you make about abortion? And, you know, we've been a part of over 50 films since 2007. Now, our mission is very simple, to use film to promote the beauty of the human person and inspire solidarity with the vulnerable. They're not all about abortion, obviously, although a lot of them have had abortion in their heart. They're going to be all kinds of films. We had Gosnell, Voiceless, Because of Gracia, October Baby, Bella. You know, we just had Unplanned. I have a new documentary coming out. Stay tuned, starring Benjamin Watson. It'll be in theaters this year, where NFL football player goes on a search to understand how we've come to this place as a country where we've legalized in states like New York the killing of children after they're born. And he makes some shocking discoveries along the way. You know, I used to think with each movie, this movie would end abortion. Bella is going to be the end of abortion. Unplanned is going to be the end of abortion. No, of course not. We just need to create a steady stream of content that tells the truth about the human person, inspires empathy, pushes people to solidarity with the vulnerable. And it's happening. You know, even in Hollywood, so many of my friends aren't Christian, aren't conservative, but are pro-life. To me, being opposed to killing your own child is like ethics 101. It's, you don't eat people and you don't hurt your own children, I think, is something everyone on earth can agree on. And we're making a lot of progress. We're losing ground in a lot of places. But and also thanks to technology, and also because tragically so many people have personally experienced abortion, it's kind of hard to sell abortion as a bat mitzvah to a woman who's had an abortion, right?
Right. Yeah. So one of the things that I think it has changed is you have in the last, well, we saw this in the, I think it was the Academy Awards a week or two ago, whenever that was. We now have the Shout Your Abortion moment, where I don't even know what her name was, but she got up and says, you know, I wouldn't have been able to win this award if I hadn't aborted my child. You remember that? Who was
that? You know, it was heartbreaking. And then what was the most heartbreaking about all of that was watching the other women, how they reacted to that, how they cried, you know, they broke down crying. And you realize that all those women who were responding that way, I have to imagine, were post-abortive themselves.
Yep.
And Vicky Thorne, the founder of Project Rachel, she once said something to me that really broke my heart. She said, Jason, when men are involved in an abortion, they explode. Like all this rage and anger comes out of them. My first year in the Army, I had 3 Article 15s for fighting. My first year. You're supposed to get kicked out after one in a career. I had 3 my first year and didn't get kicked out thanks to my chain of command. But when I thought of all this energy that's been flying out of me now, you know, when Vicky told me this, it'd maybe been 15 years in the movement, to think, she said, women implode. Men explode, women implode. She said, think of all your activity, all your activism, everything going out of you coming in. And that's really devastating. And so when that actress made that statement, and I saw the other actresses just sort of had this breakdown. And that's one thing that we're hoping to accomplish in our film, The Divided Hearts of America with Benjamin Watson, is to help women understand that, listen, your religious leaders lied to you. The Supreme Court lied to you. Political leaders lied to you. The media lied to you. That when women are swept away by this choice of abortion, it's completely understandable. And tragically, there's this abortion is normal exhibit in New York. It is normal. one out of three women have had abortions. It's tragic. It's as normal as slavery was normal in Mississippi in 1840, but we need a new normal. And that's something that I think as a movement, we need to help people understand. Everyone I know in the pro-life movement, all my friends, all the leaders, they're all post-abortive, right? So it's a movement led by people who have personally had abortions, sold abortions, performed abortions. That's who makes up the pro-life movement.
Yeah. Yeah, so you kind of had this bifurcation of rah, 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 we love abortion, abortion is great, I'm happy about it, right, who are post-abortive. And then you have the people who realize, I need healing, I need Jesus, right? And it kind of seems like it's this polar. And I think maybe in the 90s and the 2000s, this was a little bit more undercover. But I'll tell you what, it seems like in the last couple of years, you know, with the really with that women's march, with wearing the pink hats and all that, you saw all these women on cameras. I guess also it has to do if we have iPhones now, everybody's got a video camera in their pocket.
It's true.
But these women who are just shouting it and proclaiming it, and there's so much emotion in this stuff, and it's kind of like, to me, it looks, maybe I'm just projecting, but it looks like they're acting like they want to look like it's so awesome, but in reality, they're just trying to find an excuse for why it happened.
Yeah, they're wrestling with it, right?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly.
The battle for abortion in America is the battle between people who've had abortions on both sides. Mm. There are post-abortive people fighting to protect women and children from the violence of abortion, and there are post-abortive people running from the reality that they know that it was a tragedy. And that's the battle. But you're right, we didn't tell this. Even, you know, I was in the pro-life movement for 11 years. No one knew what animated me. I didn't think it was my story to tell.
So you never told that?
Not for 11 years.
Wow, okay.
It wasn't until 2000. It was in 2000, I was speaking at a church in Hawaii. I was director of Hawaii Right to Life. And I was speaking to eighth graders. And it was one of those old school pro-life talks, like, this is an egg, this is a sperm, mm-hmm. you know, and then the basics of human development. And as I was going through, an eighth grade girl covered her waist and leaned forward, and just one big crocodile tear came down her face. And I remembered, as I was looking at her, this saying came into my head: when you point a finger at someone, three fingers point back at you. So I just said it out loud. I said, you know, I hope that this demonstration doesn't make you think I'm pointing a finger at you, because if I am, there are three fingers pointing back at me. So I told this little classroom of kids, I thought, okay, we're in a little basement in Mapunapuna in Hawaii. No one's going to know. And I don't want this young girl to feel bad. And so I, for the first time, shared my story. And that was the first time I connected with people in a real way. You know, all the students leaned forward. This girl who was hunched over sat up, and I could see the burden she was carrying lifted from her. And so that's when I started sharing my story. And then I felt guilty about it until in 2004, my high school girlfriend saw me on a TV show and found me and reached out to me and thanked me for doing what I was doing.
Oh, really?
Thanked me for keeping my promise.
Awesome.
Yeah, but for those 4 years, I felt guilty because I'm like, this is not just my story.
Right.
It's her story, and her father's a part of the story. And so I would share it with this guilt. But now I have her blessing. She actually, I would never use her name. She goes, please use my name, you know, when you when you tell the story. So.
All right. So how did you become Catholic? We've been weaving in and out of it, but what actually happened?
Well, you know, it's a long story. I discovered Chesterton and Bellick by some grace. I don't even know how. And I actually was more attracted to Bellick than Chesterton. And I discovered them before I discovered C.S. Lewis, and which is, I think, unusual.
Right.
But I was going to this Calvary Chapel church, and I was really in love with Jesus, and I wanted to know more. And I met some Catholics, and then I started reading the Church Fathers. You know the story. As I was reading the Church Fathers, I had this horrific, you know, I was like, oh no, I think the Catholics are right. You know, and a lot of these, I really boiled it down to you know, we disagree with Catholics, because now I'm engaged in the pro-life movement. So I've met a lot of well-formed, thoughtful Catholics by this point, and they were challenging me on some things. But it was in reading the Church Fathers that I realized I was either going to have to become Eastern Orthodox or Catholic. And I really wanted to become Greek Orthodox. So I started studying the schism in depth because I just wanted to be sure. And you realize there were several schisms, not one. And then I think it was in 1688, half of that, the world came back to the church, right? The Eastern world. And then I realized it was just prejudice, and I became Catholic. At the last minute, I turned and became Catholic instead of Orthodox. My sister, who was following behind me a few steps, actually didn't turn, and she became Orthodox, and then eventually became Catholic.
Oh, okay.
And then she was a postulant for a while. But so that was great too, to have my sister come in.
Are there many Greek Orthodox in Hawaii?
No, I'm from Chicago, and my half sister's Greek.
Oh, okay.
And
A lot of Orthodox in Chicago.
Yeah, and fortunately she had a great professor in college, and her radio station. This is a true story. My sister picked me up from the airport, and she had Relevant Radio on here in Chicago. And I said to my sister, "It's so nice of you to have this on this Catholic radio station for me." She goes, "No, my radio broke and it doesn't move, and I'm addicted to noise. And if the radio's on, this is the only station I get."
Ah, that's like divine. Yeah.
And I don't know what it is, but thank God for it. Yeah.
Cool. So she became Catholic and then became a postulant.
She did.
But didn't enter. Did?
Yeah, she was in a Romanian Catholic Rite order in Washington State for a year. And because she had this sort of affinity to the Eastern Rite. So it was a Romanian Rite Catholic church.
Okay.
Monastery. You know, they call it a monastery.
Yes.
To come from such an irreligious family and to have my sister come with me was great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, go ahead.
And I want to tell you, this is why I want to thank you and your podcast has just been great for me and so many of my friends. And in the midst of the scandals, the relentless scandals, it's just strengthened my faith in the church. You know, just and the way I would imagine being in a really bad marriage that you know is sacramental could strengthen your understanding of the sacrament of marriage.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel now. But as somebody who for 31 years, you know, I've been in Sudan in the midst of the genocides. I've been in Iraq in the Nineveh Plains with the Peshmerga a mile from ISIS. And I've been thinking about abortion every day, all day for 31 years. It can addle you. But you see that what is the good news we take for granted. And the beginning of that story of the good news is that we have this incomparable dignity, beauty, and worth. The great Protestant pastor, Francis Schaeffer, would, I guess, call that proto-evangelism. And to me, that's what I feel my apostolate is to help people understand that they have an incomparable dignity, beauty, and worth, that they're not worthless. And once people accept that, they'll want to know the source of it. And at least that's what happened for me. And so that is really our apostolate. And that's why we make these movies. I started knocking on doors, and now we're knocking on iPads and iPhones and movie theaters.
Yes.
But with the same message that don't you know that the vulnerable are being destroyed, and don't you think that we should stand in solidarity with them? And that is the church. That's what the church has been doing for 2,000 years.
Right. Because that's our Lord.
That's our Lord. Yeah, I was just thinking in Hawaii, we just had our March for Life. And I was standing on stage and I could see a statue of St. Damien. What would compel a man from Belgium to sail around the world to go live on a little island with people with leprosy, get leprosy, then die? Only Jesus Christ, you know? St. Mother Mary, the same thing. We had a monarch in Hawaii, Queen Emma, who after her son died, 4 years old, it just compelled her to see how the poor Hawaiians were living. She went door to door, knocking on haole doors, door to door, this monarch, this queen, and her husband, King Kamehameha, begging for money to get a hospital in Hawaii for the poor. What would compel a monarch to humble themselves before foreigners to ask for money for the poor, Jesus Christ. And it's been the Catholic Church that's been sailing around the world, slamming into, you know, our barbaric ancestors and
yeah.
and giving in this truth about the beauty of the human person.
Yeah.
And so this scandal is a hiccup. And we just need to, in the midst of all of this, stand for life. You know, I love that it's a Democrat from Louisiana that wrote the bill that may end abortion, you know?
Yeah.
Knowing that it was, I'm Republicans for a long time, Catholics for a long time. And, but it's been the work for 31 years of people like Joe Scheidler and Judy Brown and Father Paul Marks, when it was really challenging, when there were no resources, there were no apostolates. But it were these hardcore Catholics in the early 70s. That we're fighting upstream, and now we're about to have this victory,
which
I really believe we are. I know that in our lifetime, we will see full legal protection for the child and the womb from the violence of abortion. There's going to be new things, horrible, unimaginable things to deal with, but let's get this one behind us.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, I was an Episcopalian priest, and we would go on Thursdays. We would have a early Eucharist, a Mass. And then we would go not just a few blocks away. We'd go to the Planned Parenthood and we would pray every Thursday as they were opening the gates for girls to come in on Thursday morning. And we would pray there. And every time there were Catholics there, more Catholics than us, of course, you know, we would number 4 to 10, and there'd be sometimes up to 30 Catholics, almost always a Catholic priest out there as well. And so during that time, I got to know the Catholic priests and the lay people and pardon me, seeing them pray. And I remember seeing this one lady, she was a Catholic woman, an older but very attractive lady, and she was in the gravel. And the Planned Parenthood was in a nasty place, you know, not a high end district. In the gravel, praying her rosary. And I thought, she believes. Like she's here for the love of Jesus. She's this attractive older, you know, this lady on her knees and the gravel. It's one of those moments that just sort of punches you in the soul. And that was, I mean, people say, why'd you become Catholic? And there's so many reasons, you know, about the theology and all that. But that was one of those moments where I kind of thought, I want to be one of them. This is the tribe that I want to belong to, you know? So
that's awesome. Well, what I always say is if I could choose my religion, I'd be Episcopalian.
Hey, it's kind of like Ayn Rand. You get to be sophisticated.
Yeah.
Beautiful music, beautiful churches, usually.
Right.
You know, I would go to these expensive tea parties that had waiters at them. My job was just to show up, say the prayer, hobnob. We always had to go to these things. That's how you raise money. You're supposed to be the chaplain of the rich. So you go to these things, you say the opening prayer, hobnob for a little bit, and then they expect you to leave and then go on with their parties, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that if you could choose any religion, Episcopalian is the great one to choose. Unfortunately, I'm Catholic because it's true. But yeah, you're right. With these pro-life battles, I would say when I was an atheist, every battle starts with 90 Protestants, 9 Catholics, and me. And it ends with 7 Catholics, 1 Protestant, and me.
Right.
Because the Catholics have the constancy.
Yes.
They're there when it's hard. They stick through. The Protestant churches get these wild enthusiasms, and they'll show up for a time. But then God will call them to something else, mm-hmm. you know, when they discover how hard the going is.
Yeah. I remember at that time I preached a sermon on a Sunday and talked about abortion and preached against abortion. And one of the prominent laymen came to my office that week and he said, "Hey, you know, we really appreciate you, young, fiery priest. And I'm pro-life. This is Texas Episcopalian, not like New Hampshire, Boston, which is like women priests and all. This is more of like country boy, rich oil Episcopalian. Hey, you know, I'm personally pro-life. You know, I think most of the congregation is Republican, but you shouldn't be preaching on that. That makes people uncomfortable. It's politics. You got to knock that off." And I remember saying, "Well, if I can't preach on thou shalt not kill, what's the whole point? I mean, that's just basic Ten Commandments. I should be able to talk about that much as I want. And he goes, yeah, you shouldn't do that. And by the way, your health insurance through the Episcopal Church as a priest covers abortion. So think about that.
Oh.
He like zinged me. This is a smart man, you know? And I was
yeah, it's really sad.
And I was like, whoa, you know? And he's like, so, you know, we're Episcopalian. I think he said we're Episcopalian and we're generally against it, but, you know, don't make a big deal about it. This shouldn't be. And that was one of the things that I was like, I can't be a clergyman in this game, you know?
Right.
That's when I was like, I need a rock. I need a magisterium. I need some encyclicals. You know, I need some backup. Right, because I can't do this for another 40, 50 years with laymen talking to me like that.
Well, and that's what's great about the magisterium. Mm-hmm. People can say whatever they want. Right. Bishops can say whatever they want. Steve Bannon controversially said about something the Holy Father said. He's just a Catholic man with an opinion on that. Right. it was right what Steve Bannon was saying. It's great to be able to appeal to the magisterium. And when I get frustrated, I just went and saw Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life, which is a beautiful film. And when you think about, you know, it's about this humble Austrian farmer who refuses to swear an oath to Hitler. Even his bishop told him, just say the words and don't think it.
Right.
When you think of St. Maximilian Kolbe, why do we know the name St. Maximilian Kolbe? Every priest, every Catholic layman should have been dying in a starvation bunker in Auschwitz. So the spirit of the age, we get swept away just like everyone else. And the church is the rock, and some people will cling to it. And the spirit of the age, the gods of our city deny the dignity of the child in the womb. And most people will get swept away by the spirit of the age. Catholics will get swept away. But we need to stand strong. We need to stand against the spirit of the age. We need not to bow to the gods of the city. And I admire Catholics like you who haven't had a personal experience with abortion. For me to compromise, to sell out, to keep my mouth shut would be a personal betrayal to my own child. That's what animates me. That's why I'm doing this. If this didn't happen to me, I would have went on to college, played football, ended up teaching, coaching football somewhere, and never thought about abortion once in my life. I probably look at people who are pro-life as crazy. But because as a 17-year-old, I always think of the Mel, it's going to sound strange. I always think of the Malcolm X quote where he said, I didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on me. Mm. And I always say, I didn't choose abortion. Abortion chose me. I didn't wake up one day and say, at 17 and say, I want to spend the rest of my life thinking about this horrible thing. It fell on me. So all of those folks watching who haven't personally been responsible for an abortion, involved in an abortion, but are committed to life, I'm really grateful for that, because I wouldn't be doing this if not for what happened to me and my child.
Yeah. Beautiful. So what's next? What are you working on?
Well, I'm heading to Washington, D.C. with Benjamin Watson. And it is kind of neat for me to be making a documentary with an NFL football player when I walked away from football to stand for life as a 17-year-old boy. And now I'm working with an NFL star, and we actually have one of the owners of the Bears in our movie. So we're heading to Washington, D.C. for the March for Life. And then we'll be going down to the Super Bowl to be doing some promotion of our movie. And there's going to be a big story breaking next week in the media on our film. Okay. But our goal is to set – we've got this little documentary that's beautiful. It's cinematic. It's beautiful. My producing partner is Betsy Kennedy Reisowitz, who is actually Justice Kennedy's niece. So that's interesting. And Chad Bonham is my director, and we have an NFL star. And my goal is to get the pro-life message in sports television, sports radio, unique places, right, for the message. And that's what I look to do with film. And with Benjamin, our film's already been covered in Fox and Friends and Laura Ingraham, and it's not even finished through post yet. But we hope to be in theaters in May or September, setting our sails to the winds of this tumultuous election year, and do our little part to force abortion into the national discussion as we go forward in this next election.
Right.
And also to address the racism of abortion that's intimately, abortion is the greatest expression of racism in America today. It is truly the legacy of an ideology that we would have hoped that dwindled and died out completely in the 60s or 70s. But really, Planned Parenthood is the fruit of a virulent type of racism that was thriving in the 20s. But its fruit is in our neighborhoods today, which is Planned Parenthood. And we hope to create a national discussion on that. And then with my organization, the Vulnerable People Project, we've been building a school in Iraq. And I'm very excited. In June, I'll be going for the ribbon cutting of our first school, which is one of 200 schools that we hope to build. But the first school's almost done.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, Margaret Sanger, she wanted to eliminate the Negro.
Sounds unbelievable, doesn't it?
It's amazing.
You know, when you don't even want to say it because you don't think people will believe you. That's my job, is to tell things that I know people are looking at me like, you know, you tell them about Margaret Sanger, they look at you like you're crazy.
Right.
I tell them there are 3 million Uyghur and ethnic minorities in China in concentration camps. They look at you like you're crazy.
Right.
We live in a world where these truths are so crazy we can't even talk about them. But that's what our documentary hopes to do. And we have a wall of sound from Ben Carson to some of the founders of hip hop music.
Yes.
are in our documentary.
Good. Yeah. And I mean, imagine any other Planned Parenthood's huge in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine any other major, if it was a conservative anything and one of their founders wanted to eliminate the Negro. I mean, can you imagine? And yet they just sweep this under the rug. I mean, that'd be an interesting documentary there. Just one on Margaret Sanger, like what a witch she was.
You know, she's really unbelievable. Or maybe even a narrative feature film is something I might like to do, is a narrative feature film exploring her life, because her life was a total mess. And think how much damage. Not that I think the people working at Planned Parenthood today are racists, right? Obviously they're not, but there's a woman, a black woman who's in our documentary, who was an abortionist for Planned Parenthood. And she says that she even knew the history of Planned Parenthood when she worked there.
Mm.
She said, but she was watering an apple tree hoping to get peaches.
Right.
And she said after, you know, a decade or so of watering an apple tree hoping to get peaches, she realized all she was getting was Margaret Sanger's apples.
Yeah.
All she was getting was dead black children.
Yeah.
And she wasn't helping black women. And that was such a powerful, we interviewed several abortionists in our documentary, and their testimony was, to me, the most powerful. Because, again, they are swept away by the gods of the city, and they did early on, step by step, get lured into thinking they were helping women. And then by the time the reality of what they were doing set in, it was devastating.
Yeah.
Just like for those of us who've been who've had abortions, maybe unlike my high school girlfriend, you chose it. But maybe if abortion was presented to me as a 17-year-old in a way that was palatable, I might have chose it, right? It wasn't an option for me to even know or think. But I could see it's very easy to choose it. It's not only an option. Young people are told it's the moral option. It's the socially responsible option.
Yeah, got to go to college. So,
these young people are doing what they're told is socially responsible. And then the reality of what happens after they've had the abortion sinks in. Same thing with some of these abortion industry workers. They really went in to it trying to be socially responsible, even with a radical commitment to the common good, or a radical commitment to helping women. And then when they wake up to the reality, that's what's going to happen with our country. You asked about Donald Trump. I think he's like America boiled down to a person. He's us. And sort of his evolution on abortion, which I never believed, by the way. I met with Donald Trump in 2012. I was flown to meet with him because I wanted to interview people about potentially working for him if he was going to run for office.
Mm.
And I was flown to New York, met with him in the Palm restaurant, and I told him to his face that I would never work for him because he was still pro-choice. And I told him that he would never be president of the United States, so he's wasting his time and money. And a couple months later, he changed his position on abortion, and I thought it was just fake. But when I've seen how he's behaved as president, he's done more for our cause than Reagan.
Yeah, he has.
And I don't believe there was ever a conversion. So I've been trying to, like, I was trying to understand, well, what went on with Trump? I don't believe he ever had a conversion. I really don't kind of buy his conversion story. Even if he buys it, I don't buy it. What I think happened was Trump was always pro-life, but he was saying what he thought was the right things to say. Mm. When you see his interviews from the 90s on abortion, when he's asked, his hands go up and he yanks back. In every interview, it's bizarre. He goes, I don't like abortion. I don't want to talk about abortion.
Right.
I'm pro-choice. He even supported partial birth abortion. He goes, I hate it. It's gross. But yes, I support it. He was basically saying, pass over my house. Leave me alone. I know the guys of the city are obsessed with this. Right. I don't want to take them on. But when Trump realized that his self-interest would be benefited from saying out loud what he always knew, he's done it with courage and consistency. And that's what we need to help our country. To me, that gave me a lot of hope, because I do kind of think Trump's us boiled down to a man. America's always been pro-life, and America's always known that it was a tragedy. We need to help our country to celebrate what they've always known. And for those of us who've been involved in abortions, people got so mad at me for saying this on Facebook the other day. I tweeted out on that, abortion is normal, and I agreed with them. Abortion is normal. If you've been involved in an abortion, you're not exceptional. You're not some outlier who's done some horribly wicked thing, and no one's saying that. It's a tragedy that we've all been swept away by. Our whole society, our religious leaders, our cardinals, Catholic cardinals and bishops, priests, our Supreme Court, our families, they've all told us this is the socially responsible thing to do, and it's been devastating.
Slavery is a different category, but I mean, think about how our country, the religious leaders, I mean, the Georgetown University and the Jesuits in DC owned so many slaves. I investigated this. The Catholic priests. In fact, when Georgetown University was in trouble, they sold off a massive amount of their slaves to help keep Georgetown alive. And they sold them to Protestant slave owners who were more harsh.
Ish.
You know what I mean? So this is, you go back a long time, you have Catholics, Protestants, families, courts, police systems, everything supporting slavery, the owning of other humans. And then that was reversed. It's possible.
Yeah, and even my own lifetime, when I was in basic training, everything I stabbed, threw a grenade at, every silhouette had a hammer and sickle on it. You know, totalitarian socialism as an ideology seemed like it dominated the world and would win the world.
Right.
And it vanished in an instant. And if the Soviet Union could vanish in an instant, Mayoral and Planned Parenthood can vanish in an instant. President Reagan's the only president to write a book in office. It's called The Conscience of a Nation. And he published it in 1984, where he was directing our attention to the next great struggle, which was the battle to end abortion, which really is. As somebody who comes from atheism, I see that Western civilization is the fruit of the incarnation. The yeah. Declaration principle is the fruit of the incarnation. There have been three brutal denials of our founding principle: slavery, segregation, and abortion. The battle to protect the child in the womb from the violence of abortion is really the battle to preserve our republic, because our republic could not have lasted another 40 years after 1860 of that brutal denial of our founding principle. Segregation could not have gone for very much longer without a republic collapsing, because it was a brutal denial of our founding principle. Abortion is a brutal denial of our founding principle. And I'm not a believer in pro-life apologetics. People get offended at me for saying this. You need apologetics to explain how there's a Trinity and God became man and the incarnation and all this. You need to explain that to me, right? Explain to me how God became a man in the womb of a Jewish girl on the outskirts of the Roman Empire 2000 years ago. Don't kill your children. Yeah. It's that simple. Let's not make it more complex. It's very simple. We protect the most vulnerable members of the human family. We all know the child. If I, as a 17-year-old high school dropout who was last in his class, knew the basics of human development and understood that that was a human person in the womb of my high school girlfriend. Everyone on the Supreme Court gets that, right? we don't need to explain to people that it's a human person that's being destroyed by abortion. Our mutual friend Dallas Carter, together with hundreds of First Nation people, are descending on the Capitol. I don't know if you know that.
Yes, I know. It's awesome.
And all of them are having like sort of their tribal statements that go back centuries in some cases, condemning abortion as destroying the child in the womb from the violence. We all get what abortion is. And these First Nation people they're coming with all of these documents where we denied the personhood of First Nation people, right? Mm-hmm. We acknowledge they were human beings, but they're not persons. And so this is the same battle, yeah, right?
You see this on Twitter. There's so many pro-abortion people saying, they even are admitting now, well, it's human, but not a human person.
Unbelievable. I mean, the Supreme Court of Virginia denied the personhood of Native Americans. The Supreme Court of the United States denied the person. How is it, Taylor, that the 14th Amendment is where Roe v. Wade reached into the 14th Amendment to support abortion? The amendment giving former slaves American citizenship is where the Supreme Court found the right to abortion. How offensive is that?
Insane. It's insane.
Yeah.
One good thing is that we have it used to be, and I'm sure you ran into this in the early days, getting the message out with the mainstream media was so difficult. Now that we have all these alternative sources, it seems to be a lot easier, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, no, it is a lot easier. And a lot of it, I just think, was our lack of sophistication of a movement. Mm. We were a movement that was founded by, you know, Judy Brown was the secretary at Kmart, I believe, and Father Marx was this parish priest. And so, you know, we weren't coming from Madison Avenue and K Street lobbyists. We were just folks. And it took us a while to learn, you know, to become sophisticated and to learn how to use the media. I think the next thing we need to learn as a movement is we're getting so much better at using media with pioneers like Lila Rose and David DeLayden and with all the pro-life films we've had. Now we have pro-life celebrities speaking up. But the next thing we need to learn as a movement is we need to learn how to harness sentiment for influence.
Mm.
We have the largest, most powerful social movement in the history of the United States. This is true. There's never been a larger social movement in this country, maybe even in the world, than the pro-life movement. When you think of how long we've lasted, real numbers, real participation, like the March for Life. So it's pretty sad that we have the largest social movement ever, but we haven't been able to harness that sentiment for influence. So that's what we're learning to do now. And this is probably going to be a big year for us.
Yes.
But each year is going to get bigger than the next. So we're learning as a movement. But we are getting much better with using media. And it's also because a lot of big stars are coming out and just saying, I'm pro-life, what? And they're finding there are no consequences. And, you know, like, what are you afraid of? Dave Chappelle's Sticks and Stones skit, I don't know if you've covered that yet. I mean, just what a critique of abortion. Yeah. Every year, South Park does an anti-abortion episode. Every year.
Yeah. And Kanye West came out with some pretty hard words.
Yeah. No, it's really, you know, when I started this in 1989, to imagine that someone like Kanye West would be standing up for, or Donald Trump.
I mean, yeah.
It's really, and I love it. Mm-hmm. I really love that, you know, Donald Trump and Kanye West are marching us into a culture of life. Like, how bizarre is that?
It's amazing. God
and beautiful.
God chooses unique, surprising tools. Just read the Bible from Genesis to the Apocalypse. It's always a surprise.
I was so upset when Trump won the nomination. I was covering the convention for the stream after Peter Thiel's speech. I just left the convention. I didn't stay for Trump's speech. I went to my hotel, watched Seinfeld, then came back to interview people after the after Trump's speech, which I didn't even watch, because I thought it was the end for the pro-life movement.
Interesting.
I just didn't believe that I didn't believe his conversion. I was the Ted Cruz guy.
Ted Cruz, yeah.
And but then to see how he has been, you know, not only that, but for the minorities in Iraq and Syria. I was in Iraq when he was nominated, and or when he was when he was sworn in. And I was in an IDP camp in Kurdistan, and all these Muslims were cheering Trump, Trump, Trump. I was so confused. And they were like, he's going to get ISIS. And I was like, do you know about the Muslim ban? They said, who wants to go to America? I want to go home. I live down that street.
Yeah, you know? Right.
It's
awesome.
And now we have Democrats like Katrina Jackson. You know, you have a Democrat state representative who wrote a bill that was signed by a Democrat governor that's now careening towards the Supreme Court and may topple Roe. Unbelievable.
Amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. All right. People are asking in the comments on the live stream here, what's the name of your new film? We can wrap up with that.
Divided Hearts of America. Stay tuned. It'll be breaking big.
It's called Divided Hearts of America?
Divided Hearts of America. Cool. Yes.
Awesome. And you say May or September. Is that what you said?
Oh, I'm sorry. My host is telling me my scapular sticking out.
That's all right.
Host. I don't think they mind as Catholic.
They're just like, okay, he's got a scapular on. This guy's legit. Okay, good, good, good.
Okay. Your scapular showing. She must be watching upstairs. Divided Hearts of America is the name.
All right, Dividing Hearts of America. It'll be out theaters, you say?
It'll be in theaters in May or September. We're shooting for May.
You know, got to go May because it's an election year, man.
Yeah, May, because that's what we're hoping. Yeah. Because, you know, our goal with this film is just to thrust into the national discussion the reality of abortion, the extremism of some of these laws. We have some surprise interviews that I can't really talk about, and folks that I can't believe agreed to be interviewed by us, and they're in the film. But we really just do want to create a national discussion on the roots of the abortion industry in America and how radical these laws have become. I mean, only 7% of Americans agree with these afterbirth abortion laws we've seen in Virginia and in New York City and in other states. You know, 63% of Americans support some actually 73% of Americans support some restrictions on abortion.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's where we are on one end, full legal protection for the human person from the violence of abortion from the moment of biological beginning, and where NARAL is. And most Americans are closer to us than they are to NARAL.
Yes.
So.
Well, great. Well, where can, is there a website? Anything people can go donate, look into it, find out more?
Yeah, you can donate. So by the way, you can go to movie2movement.com. And actually tomorrow, I think we're launching the movie site at movie2movement.com. So you'll go there now. You won't see much on the movie. Tomorrow, though, we're launching it in preparation for the March for Life, where we're sort of announcing our film. So this is really the first place I'm talking about it publicly.
Awesome. Spell it out for me. Is it T-O or the number two? How do you do it?
It's T-O, movie, T-O, movement.com. And at the March for Life this week, you'll see Benjamin on a lot of television shows, Fox and other shows we're scheduled to be on. We're going to be announcing the film. And we hope to be in theaters in May. And you can donate. This film is owned by Movie to Movement, which is a nonprofit. So it was funded fully by donors. And the marketing will be done all by donors. So you can become a part of this campaign. And our goal is to do 2,000 theatrical events opening month when we open up.
Cool. Great. Well, everybody check it out. Movie2movement.com. I put it up on the screen there so people can see it. And then I'll add it to the show notes as well. So
as I'm talking to you on my Facebook, on my Twitter, all these people are tweeting at me that are watching your show.
Awesome. Well, everybody, if you're watching right now, tweet it out. Share it on Facebook. That's a big help. You know, you can like the video. I always say, please like the video. Subscribe to the channel, of course. That way you get notifications of live streams. We're live right now with Jason Jones. But one of the biggest things is just the power of social media. Put it on Twitter, put it on Facebook, and then if five of your friends watch it and their five friends and five friends. And it's really remarkable how these things work out.
Well, what's great about you, it used to be like we all watched the same thing, right? Yeah. Like we'd all watch Monday Night Football. We'd all watch the same three. We all watch Facts of Life or Growing Pains or whatever. Now you're the only show that all my friends watch.
Awesome.
So you are.
Well, I want to get out there. I keep telling this of Dallas Carter. And Dallas has been on before. We talked about fighting and jiu-jitsu and whatnot. I want to get out there and I want to do like a Latin mass and like some Thomism and some pro-life and then just do like kickboxing and jiu-jitsu. And
Hawaii is the jiu-jitsu
Mecca,
you know. And how is this? I just traded speaking at an event in exchange for free private lessons with Greg Jackson.
Deal. Done it.
Yeah. I said, I'll come to New Mexico for free. Give me some lessons with Greg Jackson. Right. And they said, done.
That's what I need. I need to come to Hawaii and say, I'll give a whole conference on Thomism or whatever you want. But
yeah.
You gotta bring your gi.
You could train with Helson Gracie. I mean, Helson.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Helson lives in Hawaii.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
BJ Penn, Max Holloway.
Yeah.
And come to the Mango Tree and do Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm. That would be sweet.
That's what we share in common. I mean, that's my passion. Right. You know, is martial arts.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how we kicked it. When we first mentioned, there's a good picture of us I put up on the Facebook of me. I got you in a rear naked choke.
Yeah, you're choking me. You're gonna be hearing from my lawyers.
I know. It's documented. So, all right, everybody, check out movie2movement.com. Also on the screen, you can see Jason Jones' Twitter. It's TGC with Jason. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah.
I hope so, but it's been up for the last hour and a half. So, yeah, follow Jason on Twitter at TGC with Jason, movie2movement. Anything else where they can
connect with you? Yeah, I write for The Stream. It's my favorite Christian news site, The Stream.
What is it? Stream, yeah.
The Stream. John Zmarek writes there.
Zmarek.
So check me out at The Stream as well.
Awesome. Great. All right. Well, everybody, like I said, please subscribe to the channel. Hit the notification bell. Please like the video. That tells YouTube to share this. Now, this video is, I know it's going to have problems because of the title and the description. YouTube doesn't like these kind of videos, Jason. You know that?
Really?
Every time I put up any video that says pro-life, abort, anything like that, I get a flag notice from YouTube. So I'm imagining once we hang up within the hour, if I check back here, this video is going to be flagged.
Well, that's a good thing.
It is what it is.
With the vulnerable is to become vulnerable.
There you go. So if you like this video, YouTube isn't going to help us at all. So please like it. Please subscribe. Please should share. Thanks to everyone on Patreon who supports this channel, signing more books and sending them out today and tomorrow. That's at patreon.com/Dr. Taylor Marshall. And unless you have anything else you want to add, Jason, we can close up with a prayer.
Yeah, I'm heading to the March for Life right now. I'm going to the airport. And so if you're going to be in Washington, D.C. at the March for Life, look for me. And I will be with Dallas Carter and a group of folks from Hawaii. You won't miss us.
Awesome.
They'll be in traditional Hawaiian dress in the freezing cold. So, and I'll be with Benjamin Watson. Just come by and say hello.
Awesome. That sounds great. Well, thanks for coming on, Jason. We'll close with the Hail Mary. And I'd like to have everybody join us in this Hail Mary. We do it in Latin, Ave Maria. And I'd like to offer this Hail Mary to Our Lady, that she comforts all those who are post-abortive.
Amen. Thank you.
All right.
Brother.
So we'll offer it up for that. All right. Here we go. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et hora mortis nostrae. Amen. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen.
Amen.
All right, thanks, everybody. Brother. Pray the rosary every day. If you're not praying the rosary, you're not on the team. You got to think about good and beautiful things, and the rosary is the main way you do it. What are you going to say, Jason?
No, I just said thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a great show. So, all right, everybody, if you're going to the March for Life, look out for Jason Jones. Check out the website. Follow him on Twitter. Till next time, Godspeed.